This is a Crestview Bible podcast. For more information, visit crestviewhutch.org.
I was reminded this week while on a call or two that a lot of you have strong opinions about what the weather is currently doing right now. And so I thought I would just use that and capitalize on it for an opening illustration. So our weather's been up and down, and it's been quite a consternation to some of you because it's spring. Many of you are working in your yards. We're trying to work on the beautification process. And we're not necessarily trying to win the award of Yard of the Month. It is just ending April, after all. But we've started to harvest the grass crop that is popping up weekly. It's a great cash crop that is the most harvested crop in Kansas, I think. And in my yard, a green-thumbed family member has gone to the pain of beautifying the front yard. Those plants that survived the winter have now turned from brown to green, somehow, magically. Flowers have miraculously appeared in pots that were simply characterized by dirt before. I mean, I just come home and then walk out, and all of a sudden, the dirt has turned into flowers that have been planted. It's amazing. Leaves that were buried in flower beds have been removed in favor of landscaping rock, because we all know there's all kinds of river rock running through the yards of Hutchinson. Who knew all this river rock was just at our disposal? Maybe that's our appeal for rain, right? We just think if we lay the river rock, that rains will come. So we care a lot. We care a lot about adorning our yards of all things, especially when there's a chance for growth. And that's what we feel is happening this time of year, right? There's a chance for growth. So we take the effort to adorn our yards. And we're in the book of Titus for this short series. The person Titus is part of Paul's missionary team that's going around planting churches in the first century world. Paul sent Titus to the island of Crete to help establish the church there. And the goal, what we saw in chapter 1, was to put what remains after the church had been planted, to put what remains in order. People gathered together in Christ need to know how one ought to behave in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, a pillar and buttress of the truth. That was kind of the heading of all these letters that Paul's writing to his associates as they're planting on the front lines. And in chapter 1, Titus was commissioned to put leaders in place who would point us to Jesus. So I love that picture that Luke gave us last week. And aspire to live in such a way that people could look through me and through my life and see Jesus. At the end of chapter 1, we were challenged to eliminate what pulls us from Jesus. That was the second half of Luke's message last week. And I hope that passage brought you a good bit of clarity and conviction that our primary fear should not be the outside. I know some of you come in here today and you're thinking, man, our greatest fear is all that's going on in our world. Do you understand that my greatest fear is what's happening in this room? That when we gather together, we can be neglecting Jesus, that we can be majoring on things that don't matter for a hill of beans for eternity, and we can be giving our lives to those. And so I think that's what was going on at the end of chapter 1, a good bit of clarity. Because the world, the flesh, and the devil, they've always been anti-God. You shouldn't like look on your Facebook feed and find out something's happening in Hutchinson and be like, oh my goodness, when did this happen? It's always been what the world's about. They're always anti-God. They're bent that way. Our fear should be what pulls us away from Jesus inside the church. So I hope some convictions were established last week. Whether it's actions you are engaged in, attitudes that you have, or beliefs that you're holding on to, we don't want to lean into anything or anyone more than the need we have for Jesus. And I think that's why we sang a song like we sang this morning, like, Lord, I need you. We feel that inside. We just give up on it really quickly in the church. So, in passing, we saw that if these are the challenges in the church, then some things need to be put in order in our life together. That's the other shoe dropping. So if that's true, if we need to make sure that we're not giving in to what pulls us away from Jesus, then what we're talking about today is of great importance because we need to be trained in sound doctrine. And again, if you weren't here last week, we started talking about this concept of sound doctrine. This doesn't mean that you need a theology course. It doesn't mean that you need to master a systematic theology textbook. That's not what's in view here. What was in view last time and what we're going to get clarity on today is that we need a sound doctrine that helps us know Jesus and live like him. So it's amazing. We're going to be told twice in today's passage to be exhorted to sound doctrine, and we're really not going to be given any doctrinal statements. It's all just like how we behave, as if that's how we demonstrate sound doctrine. That's how we know that we have sound doctrine in the way we live. So, I mean, it's a huge thing to come across this. We need help, we need order, we need establishing, we need equipping to live as followers of Jesus. The church in Crete needed that. Most New Testament letters are written to churches that are deviating from who they need to be in Jesus. They need equipped to be followers of him, and that's our need here at Crestview too. We're not unlike any church that's ever existed. We have needs every time we gather. We need help, order, establishing, and equipping to be followers of Jesus. So this is what this passage is after today. No matter what you come into this room this morning thinking that you need, our greatest need is Jesus. Following him is our very lives. That's what matters most in our lives, following him. So just like we saw at the opening of this book, knowing Jesus and making him known is the truth into which we're building our life together. This is what we're about as we gather together. So today, if you're still wrestling with questions, again, I fully anticipate that. I just heard a podcast on this, so I'm trying to get this out of my vocabulary. Like, if you're here today, I know you're all here today. I get it, right? So you all are present in the room. But today, you might walk into this room, and you're still wrestling with questions about Jesus in your life. There's probably someone in this room who's thinking, is my faith in Jesus really worth it? Is he really worth following? You're going to see the effort that God has put to make sure that, to ensure that his people are centering in him for all that they are. And I hope that's a witness to you so that you can see how compelling Jesus is. The aim is that if you could come to know Jesus, everything in your life would change. And so I hope you come to know him today. And if Jesus is your Lord, you're invited to give up on the individual life that you have, and you're called to benefit the life of the called out ones that we're on mission with together. So I know this is kind of like torching a glacier right now, that the way you think, most of your decisions, most all the way you go about life is just about you and Jesus, if you're a believer. And what I'm inviting you to, what I'm wanting you to see in this passage is, what if it's more about you being pulled away from that individual thinking, that God has rescued you so that you could be a benefit to others and together in the church. And I know what it's like too. I think we walk into gatherings with a business as usual mindset. We bring that into our life together, that we know what life should look like on a typical week at Crestview as you walk into the room and you have certain comforts. Okay, I grab my coffee, I sit. Oh, I don't want to talk to that person. They're chatty Cathy. Someone's there, I better move the other way, or this makes me uncomfortable. So we've positioned ourselves, even in a gathering, to be like business as usual. This is what we're doing. We're all tempted to bring that. And what I'm inviting you to is to have your life disrupted for the sake of the mission. That we've only been given, like, I was reading a psalm this morning, by 70 years, by means of grace, 80, or something like that, the text says. You know, the idea is that the life that we get to steward is short compared to eternity. So what are we going to make that life count for? What are we going to make that life count together for in the body? I mean, do you think God's put us together in the body just so we can keep you comfortable for like 40 or 50 years and then you move on? Or maybe God's put us together for a bigger purpose, that he wants us to function a certain way in the church so that we can walk with him. So I want this business as usual mindset that we're all tempted to bring into our life together to be disrupted today. For the sake of the mission, so that knowing him, knowing Jesus and making him known would be the path that we tread on our life together. So that's where we're headed. And I invite you to join me as we see three ways our church adorns Jesus. Three ways that our church adorns Jesus. So let me read Titus 2, 1 to 10. Somebody said about this passage that this is a no-win text for a preacher to preach. If you lean a little left, there's going to be ways I'm going to thoroughly disappoint you today. If you lean right, there's going to be ways that you're going to be disappointed. And hopefully, we're all going to be edified as we see how this passage relates to Jesus in our life together. So, Titus 2, 1 to 10, let's see what I'm talking about. Follow along with me as I read this. Here's what Paul writes to Titus. As for you, teach what accords with sound doctrine. Older men are to be sober-minded, dignified, self-controlled, sound in faith, in love, and in steadfastness. Older women, likewise, are to be reverent in behavior, not slanderers or slaves to much wine. They're to teach what is good, and so train the young women to love their husbands and children, to be self-controlled, pure, working at home, kind, and submissive to their own husbands, that the word of God may not be reviled. Likewise, urge the younger men to be self-controlled. Show yourself in all respects to be a model of good works, and in your teaching show integrity, dignity, and sound speech that cannot be condemned, so that an opponent may be put to shame, having nothing evil to say about us. Bondservants are to be submissive to their own masters in everything. They are to be well-pleasing, not argumentative, not pilfering, but showing all good faith, so that in everything they may adorn the doctrine of God our Savior. This is God's word. Thanks be to God. So three ways that our church adorns Jesus. And first, our church adorns Jesus as older people pass on their identity in Jesus. Older people pass on their identity in Jesus. In verses 1 to 3, we have some language to older people. And before we jump in and jump off into this first point, you can readily hear what I had to wrestle with all week, that there are all kinds of terms like young and old, men and women, bondservants and masters that call for attention in this passage. And I'm summarizing these opening designations as older and younger. I think you're tempted to hear this as maybe just an age thing. If the average life expectancy in the first century world was 40 years old, who would be considered the older people? You know, like all of us, maybe? who would be considered younger? You know, like, and so I think what the, and you might think, well, what does the original language mean? Don't you know the original language? Well, yeah, I mean, I've studied it for, I had 5 years of studies on that. The passage is intentionally left ambiguous, right? It's not pointing out that older people and younger people, like in terms of age, are the right categories. It's helping us think this could mean in terms of maturity, like older people and younger people, people who get it and people who don't. We have those in our human families, right? When you had younger children at home, I know, are my kids the only one that fight on Sundays? So I talked to a couple of families just to check in today, like, am I human? Do you experience this too? And they're like, no, our children are perfect. Yours are just the anomaly. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah. It's good. No, but no, we get that, right? That there's people in our, like, there's, I don't want to embarrass my children. There are children in my home that get that, get things related to life better than others at this stage of their lives, right? So wouldn't that be the case in the church then too? That there are people in our life together who, in a sense, get it, who are more mature, who have processed things a little differently. And it's not like how long they've been a Christian. It's not like that they're just older. It might be the case that they're older. It might be the case that they've been a Christian a long time, but they're mature. I've talked to international workers, and there's international workers that have gone overseas when they're younger. And what happens when the, in the Titus 2 sense, older people in the room are like 20 years old telling 60-year-olds who haven't been trained in the faith how to live. Who's the younger and who's the older in that context? So we just got to be careful. This is probably ambiguously left that it's something, if you're older, maybe you aspire to this, but it's certainly in view as maturity. So right from the outset, lest I get drug into too many rabbit trails here, right from the outset, older people are passing on their identity in Jesus. That's how I'm summarizing these older men and older women. They're passing on an identity in Jesus. we've already discussed sound doctrine a bit, that they know Jesus and they live accordingly. So whether it's older men or older women, they're passing on something that we are. They're passing on something that they are, right? So do you see that in the text? What are they to do? Older men are to be. Older women, likewise, are to be. In other words, it's saying that you know Jesus. You're to live a certain way. There's a certain embodiment that you have about this way of life in Christ. They're to act in specific ways because they know Jesus. Because Jesus is informing how you live, you pass on that difference to others. You pass on the difference that Jesus is making in your life to others. That's what's going on. And I think we're on the right path there, because if we read verses 1-3 in the context of chapter 1, remember the problem of chapter 1 was that there were people who were upsetting whole families in Crete. The actions and attitudes of beliefs were upsetting whole families. Those were the issues that needed to be addressed. In that case, we can readily see the difference in identity in Jesus makes. So if we're taking our cues from who Jesus is and how he's called us to live, then being sober-minded, as the text says, look at that in verse 2, sober-minded, dignified, self-controlled, they all speak of Jesus looming larger in how people think and how they act and how they live. That Jesus is calling the shots there. That's what leads them to be sober-minded. They're thinking differently, dignified. They're living differently and self-controlled. The way they're acting is being clarified by something other than themselves. So being sound in faith, sound in love, sound in steadfastness, it points to a grounding that's happening vertically as we relate to one another. That they are grounded, they are sound in what they believe, sound in how they love, sound in how they persevere through all that. And what's grounding them? Jesus is. He's the one that's informing the way they live. Or older women, they're to showcase their identity in Jesus by being controlled in their behavior, speech, and how they cope with life. It's the same thing, right? Jesus is calling the shots. He's informing how we live, how we cope with life. And these older people are teaching what is good. And what is good is their identity in Jesus that changes everything for them. And they're passing that on to other people. So is this the residue that you're leaving on other people in our life together? If this isn't flowing from you, maybe you've either overestimated your maturity, or it could be the case that you don't find an identity in Jesus to be very compelling, that he just doesn't wow you, so you'd rather put your identity in something else. So could I just plead with you to give up on anything that rivals Jesus in your affections? There's all kinds of ways you could build your life on hundreds of good things. They're not Jesus, and they're not going to deliver. They might make for great life hacks or great social media stuff, but they're not Jesus. Build your life on him, and then pass that on to others. That's the calling of these opening verses. It's time for us to be awakened to who we are in Jesus and how this changes everything. And when we're awakened to that, we're going to tell others about it. We're going to help them to know this. So to be a church that adorns Jesus, older people pass on their identity in Jesus. Secondly, another way that our church adorns Jesus is younger people are trained in Jesus' mission. Younger people are trained in Jesus' mission. In verses 4-8, we have some fun verses. And honestly, my first thought as I read these verses again was we have verses that have been weaponized to lay large demands of law on younger people. And adorning Jesus is certainly what's in view here. So training is the call for more youthful, more immature people in the church. It's training. There's a sense in which we all need trained. there's issues that are happening that I need trained in, that I have to go back and read books and, oh, how do I make sense of this and how can I help others? There's a sense in which we're all growing. We haven't arrived yet. Training is the call for all of us. And in this verse, it's particular, right? Younger women are given directions to show how this sound doctrine, this life in keeping with Jesus, this life-altering word is honored among them. And it starts with their homes. That's where those impulses to be on mission begin. The lives of women are trained so that their lives are propelling Jesus' mission into others. So they're doing that if they're married with their husbands or with, if they have children with their children. Her husband and children are affected by how she lives. But I just want to clarify here, this passage is not mandating that women must be married. It's not mandating that women can't work outside the home. If you've ever read the Bible, you know that in women's ministry circles, Proverbs 31 is the cat's meow. And Proverbs 31 woman does not work at home. She's out selling stuff in the marketplace. She's out establishing her husband's reputation out there. So the Bible's not like limiting and saying, well, if you're really going to live your best life, you're going to be at home and you can't have a career. That's phooey. I read the Bible. So I just want to free some of you from that burden, right? And some women are called to that. It's great. Some women are called. Like, I'm not going to choose a career. I'm going to be home and be with my children. Great. It's fine, but that doesn't mean you're more holy than someone else just because God called you to that. There's people, women who work outside the home, just like Proverbs 31 woman, and it's a great thing. It's blessing all people, not merely those in her home. That's what a Proverbs 31 woman does. So there's lots of specifics there, right? Training young women. They're being trained on mission, and mission begins like in the home and then spreads out to others. Those younger people are being trained from those older people. Hey, this is how this looks like to live this out in the world. This is how this looks like to live it out in the home and then as it goes out to others. It's ground zero. So younger men are called to be self-controlled. So this isn't a cheaper calling. You might look at this and say, well, look at all the number of things that women have and younger men are just told to be self-controlled. Yeah, that's a big issue for men, I promise you. It's not a cheaper calling. I think I could say confidently, I checked this with the elders kind of last elders meeting, that every issue of men maturing into Jesus' mission, every issue that we deal with is a self-control issue. Every issue. Every issue. When a guy overthinks, when a guy overthrows his coverage, when a guy thinks too much of himself, when a guy's addicted to porn, when a guy's not doing things right in his home, it usually all circles back to a self-control issue. A self-control issue. So, I mean, again, how wise of God just to say, oh, I got my finger right on the pulse here. Boom. That's it. Self-control. And so the issue in saying self-control, because self-control was a mission for younger women too, the issue with self-control is, are you going to be the center or is Jesus? That's really what the training is. Are you going to be the center or is Jesus? That's a self-control issue. And these countercultural ways of living are propelling us outward. So if what I'm saying is true, then we would see that in other verses. And look at verses 7 and 8. Look at what Paul tells Titus. He's basically saying, yes, so the outward impulse is here. Verses 7 and 8 confirm that, that the aim is the mission. And how Titus teaches and in how he lives, he is to be speaking in a way that propels others outward and has an effect so that he can't be condemned, right? So that people can't say, oh, you're nothing. So that he can't, so that his opponents are put to shame. So he's equipping people to such a degree that it's having a winsome effect in the community as people are on mission. People are being trained. And as these younger people are being trained in the mission, it's having an effect. That they're having an effect in the mission. Opponents are put to shame and they have nothing evil to say. I mean, don't you just wish that that was the case? Like that we could so relate to outsiders in the community that they would be put to shame and they would have nothing evil to say to us because we are majoring on the majors. And not on the minors. So this is what we're laboring for in training others. We want the mission of knowing Jesus and making him known to be skillfully embraced so that others in the community feel the impact. So just like Paul desired for this establishing work to have outcomes on Crete, what would be our impact if we were trained? If we were not only, if we were training people, but if we were being trained in such a way that we weren't condemned by the world. The world was put to shame and they had nothing evil to say about us. You're thinking, like, it can't be that easy. Well, I think the rest of the chapter makes a pretty strong case that it is really that easy. Like, when you read verses 11 through 14 and why Paul instructs Titus with good news that informs good works there, kind of is in this context of Titus is probably wondering, is this really going to work? Like, if I really encourage these older people to live out of the reality of who they are in Jesus, and I really am working to train up younger ones, more immature people, so that they can function better in the mission, is this really what you want me to be about? Yeah, that's what he's saying here. Again, I think one thing that stands out from the text, looking back over those verses again, is the commonality of being self-controlled, which is so significant. I mean, I think every group gets an encouragement to be self-controlled. It's almost as if God envisions that we're going to be having a conversation in 2021, or whatever year it is, 23. God's envisioning that we're going to be thinking and wrestling with this text, and our tendency is going to be, that can't be how he's wanting us to live. There's got to be more. There's got to be more important things than Jesus. We're going to be mounting a defense as to why we can't be about his mission. That surely there's more important things. Surely, like, knowing Jesus and making him known, there has to be more. Surely it's not just this. And so he tells every single one of us in this room to be self-controlled. To make sure you're not wrapping your life up too much in yourselves, but in what he wants for us. He's assuring us that Jesus is not only compelling, but Jesus is also worth it. So will we be so wrapped up in Jesus that making him known to others is the impulse of our lives? Will we give ourselves to that impulse, to that mission, so that others know him? And we're pressing into that. So in our desire to adorn Jesus, younger ones must be trained in Jesus' mission. And if we're still wondering if that's the right direction, the passage ends, third and finally, that a church that adorns Jesus will have workers who display Jesus to their employers. Workers who display Jesus to their employers. So we end in verses 9 and 10 with this bondservants and masters language. I don't think Paul put this in the Bible so that we could drag bondservants and masters out of this text and have a discussion about whether or not the Bible's encouraging slavery or not. I don't think that's his primary purpose in context. For us in our country, slavery looms large in our minds because our country's history involved marginalizing and explaining away that a group of people in our community even existed for many years. And I think there's all kinds of texts in the Bible that would say you shouldn't devalue people in that way. So slavery in our country isn't on the horizon here. Treating people as inferior based on status, that's not what's in view here. It's first century servanthood in homes allowed for employment in the home. And it was there to help families. And it provided the worker with stable income. And a bondservant could be set free. They weren't bound to that. So Paul wants Titus to ensure that there are these other members of your home that are on display here. And the mission even extends there, right? This calling even extends into these places. That the church's life together is roped into this invitation to adorn Jesus in ways that are in keeping with sound doctrine. So workers display Jesus to their employers. Workers display Jesus to their employers by having their eyes on Jesus and acting accordingly. So Jesus is what is at the front and center. They know Jesus, so sound doctrine informs their work. They're to do their job well, and they're to front load their motivation in what they believe about Jesus. So what this passage is telling us is that our primary goal isn't primarily just to make money, although that helps really practically. It isn't to build a portfolio, which again has practical help in providing for your family and caring for them. What's front-loaded here is what we know about Jesus and our accountability to him. So, workers aren't to be a pain to their bosses. So if you are a pain to your boss, well, yeah, it's kind of subjective, isn't it? Just consider yourself. Just look at yourself. Is Jesus my motivation here? So we don't want to be a pain to our bosses. We don't want to be a pain to our Lord. That's kind of what this passage is. Because everything that we do is adorning a way of life. And what's that way of life showing? Is it adorning sound doctrine? Is it adorning the way of life that goes with Jesus? Or is it making people scratch their heads and go, what? You're a Christian? That's a shocker. I didn't realize that. No, there's a way of life in keeping with Jesus and following him. Not that we live lives of sinless perfection, but that, no, our eyes are so fixed on Jesus and his mission is at the front of how we're interacting in the workplace. So is Jesus in view in your life's work? Or have you slowly drifted into thinking that something else is more in view and more primary? Maybe your life work is currently a field of study that we call retirement. Maybe that's your life work. What would it look like for you to pass on this kind of work ethic to others? This kind of work in keeping with Jesus? This adorning Jesus, this displaying Jesus in the workplace. What would it look like for you to pass that on to others? If you're currently working, how might Jesus sustain you? How might he provoke you? How might he make a difference in your life that will help you be an employee in that moment? So, in inviting us to adorn Jesus with sound doctrine, Paul's urging Titus in this section to make sure that people are always on when it comes to the relationship with Jesus. So no days off. Like, you can't just say, oh yeah, I live for Jesus every day. But Monday through Friday, I think that's part of what this is getting at, right? There's no divide between the sacred and the secular. It's all becoming sacred because Jesus is always in view. We're always adorning sound doctrine. So it's not like, well, this is just work me and Christian me is over here and this is family me. This is bringing it all together and saying, no, Jesus is all of that. Jesus is to be the center of all of that. So we're always on when it comes to our relationship with Jesus. There are no days off regarding our life as a church or our life in Jesus. Whether we're in one stage of life or another, one work situation or being at home, thinking of what's best for us or not, Jesus is center stage, and he's the one adorning our lives so that not only do we know him, but we're making him known to others. That's the point here. Now, I know we probably fall into this tendency of we want to read this passage as law. So do you know what I mean when I say reading a passage as law? You're wanting to read this passage and say, yeah, but the passage is saying you ought to do this and this and this. And I think we want to do that, and we want to draw it with markers so that we don't have to have this ambiguous category of living for Jesus. Because if I can just say, well, I'm self-controlled, get off my back. That's way easier than saying, is Jesus the center of your life? You know, right? So we want to capture this in law. So Luke hit on this last week a little bit, and I think it's just relevant because I think every church drifts to that. I think there's probably women in this room who have read this passage and think, okay, well, this is what a younger woman's to do. So is she loving her husband? Is she loving her children? Are these young moms self-controlled? Are they pure? Are they working at home? Are they kind or submissive? Well, there's the rules. Let's check them off and let's start looking at people with that. It's really easy to do that, right? But it's way more difficult to say, okay, my responsibility is not to check off a list. My responsibility is to train these moms to love Jesus and his mission. How can I step into that? And I think that's what the spirit of this passage is. I don't think Paul's telling Titus, You know, Jesus can change lives, but what's really going to change lives are the list of rules I'm about to give you. So let's get people to work doing these rules. I don't think that's what he's saying. Otherwise, verses 11 through 15 of chapter 2 make no sense. If it's just law, why does he need to say, hey, you know what? The grace of God has appeared, and it's brought salvation to everyone, so that we can renounce ungodliness and worldly passions and live self-controlled and upright and godly lives, waiting for our blessed hope, the appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us. Why does he need to say that if it's just a bunch of law-keeping? He's saying that because Jesus has to be everything. And when Jesus isn't everything, then there's big problems. Whole families are upset. And so that's another good test for our application of this passage, right? Is what you're proposing, could it upset whole families and cause them to be distracted from Jesus? Then we know we're probably on the wrong scent. Because in keeping with Jesus, yeah, that doesn't mean, I'm not suggesting that following Jesus doesn't mean we're never going to be asked to do hard things. So I think that's in the air too. That, well, there's part of this that I don't really feel like doing, so therefore, because I'm following Jesus, I'm not going to do that. Well, okay, right, sure, let's just all give up. No, it's about our hearts. It's about a change in heart that Jesus brings that changes everything. That changes how we relate to others in the body. It changes what I do with my maturity. It changes what I need to grow in. It changes how the practice of the mission needs to be affected. Those are the things that Paul's after. It changes what it looks like in the workplace when Christians go out into it. That's what's in view. So are we going to walk in that? So in conclusion, we've seen three ways that our church adorns Jesus. That older people pass on their identity in Jesus. Younger people are trained in Jesus' mission. And workers display Jesus to their employers. So Jesus is everything to us. He's everything to us. An old hymn centers our lives in Jesus and his love by telling us, love so amazing, so divine, demands my life, my soul, my all. And Jesus went all in for us, right? He came to earth and he lived a life of sinless perfection. He embodied this. He embodied what it means to live for God fully every day of his life. He embodied what it meant to look like a young man growing and learning. And we have those stories in Luke 2, right? He embodied what it looked like to have maturity and relate to others and to deal with numbskulls who are proposing crazy things like cutting people's ears off and offering to topple the Roman government for him. Jesus showed what it was like to be steady in all those things. And he also showed like what it was to like work, right? And to live in that sphere. So, but on top of his godly example, he died for us. He died for people who don't get it right. So you might be thinking here and saying, there's no way I could live up to that standard. Of course you couldn't. You couldn't live for God for 10 minutes if you tried. And the fact that you think you might be able to is further exposing the reason you could never do it, because that's just arrogance. You're way overestimating yourself. So 10 minutes, we couldn't do that. And Jesus died for all that. He died for all that sin. He died for all that failure. He died for all the shame we have of just thinking about what we've made of our lives. He died for all that. And he also rose from the dead so that the word would be life as we come to know him. That he's not sent us on this morbid life journey. He sent us on one that's full of life because he rose from the dead. He gave us life to the full. I mean, we have everything in him. Showing that his resurrection, it showed that God had accepted his sacrifice. And then on top of all that, he ascended to heaven and put his feet up and he rules. He dominates the world right now in all that he is risen. I mean, he has it and he reigns. So he's everything and he's changed our lives. He gives us life eternally and he gives us life in the here and now for all that we need. So we're invited to give up and trust him. So having trusted him, this passage invites us to adorn our lives with what he's done. That we're adorning our lives with his work. Just like you would beautify your garden in the idea that it's going to grow. We're beautifying our lives with what we've seen today so that we can grow as a body. This means that our life together in the body is affected. Older, more seasoned ones in Jesus are passing on the difference he makes for their lives. So pass that on to others. Passing on what it means to be found in him and all that goes with that. All the freeing and joyful elements that go with that and all the struggles. Younger, newer seeds in the soil of this seedbed are being trained to see how knowing him propels us outward from our homes into lives and work. So we're being trained in that, trained in mission. And as we go out into workplaces, which are extensions of our life together, we don't get dropped from the Jesus Project. No, that's where the Jesus Project is happening as well, right on the front lines of where we work. We get to know Jesus and make him known right there in that workplace. So an adorning church loves adorning Jesus because of all the growth that's possible. I mean, just think of it. Think of this place and all that God's done. I mean, think of your own life and how God's matured you. I mean, if you've been here for any measure of time, you can see how God's moving the needle of your life and how he's shaping you and just working all things in your life, rooting out things. And I mean, I don't think that's happening because we're just punching people in the throat every week and like, hey, take this, you better live rightly. No, it's just happening as we center on Jesus, and that's the culture. We're just saying to one another, can you believe that God has done this for us? Oh, you're struggling. Man, I'm with you in that struggle. That stinks. Can we walk with you? Can we love on you? I mean, it's just, this is what an adorning church does. It adorns Jesus because of all the growth that's possible. We can't believe that this is possible with him. So might we as a people know him and make him known to others as we strive to glorify and enjoy him forever.